So it's my pleasure now to introduce our faculty speaker, Hod Lipson. Hod is an associate professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering and computing and information science. He directs the Creative Machines Lab, which focuses on novel ways for automatic design, fabrication, and adaptation of virtual and physical machines. He has led work in areas such as evolutionary robotics, multi-material functional rapid prototyping, machine self-replication, and programmable self-assembly. Lipson received his PhD from the Technion Israel Institute of Technology in 1998 and continued to a postdoc at Brandeis University and MIT. His research focuses primarily on biologically inspired approaches as they bring new ideas to engineering and new engineering insights into biology. His talk today is entitled Curious and Creative Machines, Design and Creativity in the Age of Intelligent Machines. Please join me in welcoming Hod Lipson.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to speak here today, and it's good also to see a couple of students here. I'm in the mechanical engineering department, and I teach two courses. One course in mechanical engineering, and that is product design, where we look at how to design products and so forth, and I keep learning new ways to design, and what we teach is not quite true because everything is moving forward so quickly. The other course that I teach is Foundations of Artificial Intelligence. And you might wonder, okay, how come you teach, what are these courses having anything to do with each other? And I think the main idea that I want to convey to you today is that a lot of the direction that design is moving in, and it's true for software, has been true for software and for electronics for a long time, but also for shapes and forms and mechanical things, it's incorporating more and more computer-aided design, intelligent design systems, and design automation in various ways and form, which is leading us more and more to this question, can machines design new machines from scratch? Can machines come up with new ideas on their own? Can machines be creative? From the science point of view, the question is, can machines ask questions? Can they make discoveries? And so that kind of led me to this fundamental questions of, can we make curious and creative machines, which is what I want to talk to you today about. Hopefully you can switch to my presentation, and I can start telling you a little bit about some of the different projects that we're doing right now. And I'll tell you a little bit about the story of how we got to talk to kind of investigate these things. This is, by the way, a kind of martini glass designed by a computer made with rapid prototyping out of silver. We had a hard time pushing this through accounting, why we need silver martini glasses, but we managed to do that, and here it is. So our lab focuses a lot on this issue of robotics, and robotics today are superhuman in almost any way you want to measure it, in speed, in accuracy, in power, in ability to work 24/7, but there's one area where they lack, and that is their ability to create and be creative. So these machines are anything but creative. They do everything well as long as everything is in the right place at the right time, but if something goes wrong, if they need to improvise, it's difficult. So that's one of the biggest frontiers in engineering today, in robotics, is how to make machines that are adaptive, that can improvise, that are creative, that can use resources in new ways. And so back, I guess, more than a decade ago, we started looking at ways where we can use evolutionary processes to design machines. And this is one of our first experiments back in 2000 when we looked at evolutionary processes that would design robots by breeding them rather than by designing robots explicitly. So what we did is we threw a bunch of robot parts into this big simulated vat of robot parts, joints, wires, and things like that, and we bred robots for a particular task, in this case, their ability to crawl across the table. And at the end of the day, we got these interesting machines crawl out of the system. These were converted from the virtual world into the physical world with rapid prototyping technology. And we kind of got these interesting kind of designs of robots. So that was, here's a kind of close-up of one of these machines. You can see it has a pretty kind of unusual shape and form produced entirely through this process of breeding. And so that was enough to get us on the front page of New York Times. It wasn't, you can't do that today, but back then you could get this sort of thing on the front page. And but if you look at this, it's about robotics, but the underlying tone here is really about design and manufacturing. We're getting to the point where machines, robots, can design and make new robots. Okay, and this touches on a lot of interesting questions about who's the designer, who owns intellectual property, all these kind of interesting things. How can we push this? Does it accelerate? How does it catalyze our ability to design new things, and where will it go? So that was enough to land me my faculty position at Cornell. But the question was, am I going to get tenure? And there's no way I'm going to get tenure by making plastic robots in the mechanical engineering department. So we made a titanium robot. This is the robot that you see here. It's very complicated. It has lots of pistons and all kinds of. It's pneumatically controlled. It has a paintball canister in the center. It's pretty difficult to make this thing move forward. And we use the same kind of breeding processes, these evolutionary processes, to design controllers or brains, if you like, to make this machine move forward.
Sequence of,
and here you can see some of the behaviors that came out of kind of
this is the first, the random species
to control.
Then this one,
robots.
This one is a bit better.
So you can see this is one of the kind of the first early breeds of behaviors here. It's beginning to learn how to walk from its own experiences, and gradually it's getting better and better. But you can see that we're still not going to take over the world anytime soon with this thing. So this is an example, though, of how we use these evolutionary processes to design software,
you
to design
better and better.
A structure in a way that kind of bypasses a lot of the traditional methods. The kind of last project that we'll kind of that I want to, so hopefully you'll see the connection with this issue of curiosity in a minute. This was a project where we took a four-legged machine and we wanted it to learn how to walk. Now, this is an interesting machine. It has four legs. It has eight mortars, one at the hip and one at the knee of each leg. And it has two tilt sensors that tell it how it's tilted left and right, forward and backwards. And it needs to learn how to walk. Now, what's particularly interesting about this machine is that it does not know that it has four legs. It doesn't know if it's a snake, doesn't know if it's a spider, if it's a tree, doesn't know how the pieces are arranged or what it looks like. Maybe not unlike a brain of a newborn child that needs to control a body and deal with all the inputs and outputs. So how can it learn what to do? So the basic idea, and this is a kind of making it a kind of very, describing it at a very high level, but the idea was that this machine would first learn what it is, and then with that knowledge, it will learn to do something. It will solve a problem. In other words, the first part is a kind of curiosity-driven, and the second part is the design. So what it does, and I'll show you this in a movie in a moment, the robot will begin by moving its motors in a random way, and it will feel all kinds of sensations, all kinds of accelerations from its motors. It will then form all kinds of hypotheses at the top left of what it is. And it will say, okay, if I'm a snake-shaped, then the way I move my mortar should have created these kinds of sensations, but I didn't feel those sensations, therefore I am not a snake. Maybe I'm a spider, maybe I'm this, maybe I'm that. And it can go through lots and lots of hypotheses with only a brief interaction with reality. It will go through thousands, millions of hypotheses, and it will find out a group of hypotheses that match up with these experiences. It will then take those experiences, and here's the critical step in the green box. It will figure out what's the best action it can do to cause the most disagreement between predictions of these models. Why the most disagreement? Like a scientist designing an experiment that causes the most disagreement between predictions of two competing theories, because then the result from the experiment will refute at least one of those theories. It finds that action, and it does it in physical reality, and the sensations that it has will refute some of the models, the hypotheses, and improve others and so forth. At some point, it stops doing this. Is my voice coming in and out? So at some point, it will stop doing this cycle, and we'll go back and take the model that it created and use it to design a particular gate that will make it move forward. And because the model is close to reality, it will also, what works in simulation will work, make it move forward. So this is one of our first experiments. When we have a robotic system, you always have the camera rolling because you never know if it's the last time the robot's gonna work. So here's the robot doing its thing. Unplugged itself.
So that
didn't work, but here's one that did work, and we kind of tamed the robot a little bit as it's learning about itself. And here it is doing its first action. And then here are all the hypotheses it's forming about what it might look like. Now, when you see this, you know all these hypotheses are wrong. But insofar as the robot knows, these are all valid hypotheses because they match up with its sensations. Here's the 8th out of 16 trials. It's beginning to figure out what it looks like. It doesn't quite know it has 4 limbs, but it kind of begins to see that. And this is the 16th out of 16 trials, and it's pretty much figured out that it has 4 legs and how they're connected. The positions aren't exactly right, but it's more or less correct. Here's a second stage where it's designing its gait. It's figuring out how it can use that self-image that it created to move the fastest that it can. And we were hoping to get an evil spider wheel, but instead we got this lame way of moving forward. But when you look at this, you have to remember that this robot was not programmed to move. It did not have a model of itself, nor did it do trials of walking before this. Right, so we managed to kind of bypass all these issues and have the machine figure out, based on a brief interaction with reality, what it is and how it can move. Here's another test. We removed a leg from this robot. It was very sad, I know, but we put it back. And the robot senses that, and then it's in about a day, its self-image changes, and it learns how to move. So here it moves without this leg, and kind of, we probably could have designed a better way to move forward manually, but the idea is that there was no sensor that said, leg came off, switch to plan B. This is all spontaneous and so forth, and it works in reality. All right, just to give you a little bit of data. Here are 30 independent runs. The red dots are where the robot gets with a random motion. If it just just shakes its motors. The black dots are where the robot thinks it's going to get to using its self-image that it generated. And the blue dots are where it gets to in reality. So as you can see, just like anything else in academia, this robot has an inflated self-image. But nevertheless, it's interesting that that inflated self-image allows it to make the right kind of decisions as to what to do and what not to do in its design process. So that was kind of an interesting idea. And of course, we're taking it into a lot of different ways. Robots modeling not themselves, but other robots. Even I know, anybody here see this movie? Okay. This is an experiment we did. We were having two robots interact with each other. These are avatars talking to each other. It got 2.8 million views, which is pretty nice. You should watch it if you haven't, but not now. Watch it when the panel is speaking, not later. And then, but it's so interesting to see how these things kind of generate their own material. This, I thought, was a pretty amazing line to come out of a robot. It's now on T-shirts, I have seen. And of course, the ultimate question is, can we have a robot model not its body, but model its way of thinking, okay, which is beginning to touch on these issues of self-awareness and so forth. So you can apply this to all kinds of things. We can apply it to finding structural identification on bridges and things like that. And these are all projects that we've done. You probably recognize this bridge. But at some point, we realized that we were becoming a bottleneck of allowing this algorithm to use in different ways, and we created this software. It's online, and there are now 30,000 users. And what they do is they paste data from some experiments into spreadsheet-like software. They hit enter, and the machine tells them what's going on in that data, what kind of equation is going on, what it's describing it, and it uses that Excel sheet as an experiment, that it goes there, it asks a question, and then looks up the answer, and the Excel sheet comes back and gradually infer what's going on. So it's obviously Eureka, misspelled, so it can be found in Google, and that's our work. So lots of people are using it. As I said, 30,000. Half of them are trying to predict the stock market. And some of them successfully, I hear. I haven't been successful, that's why I'm here. And the others are doing it for science, big science and small science, citizen science, and so forth. So that was the first part where I talk a little bit about curiosity, how we can get machines to ask questions. And it's all about making the machines come up with hypotheses and then come up with questions or actions that disambiguate these hypotheses. And that's kind of how we get the machines to ask questions. It's being applied in lots and lots of different areas. The kind of harder question is how we get machines to be creative. And I want to show you just briefly a couple of different projects that use this idea. I'm going to start with something that we don't tend to talk about in engineering, and that's art. So we actually looked at, can we get a machine, a robot, to make paintings that are kind of interesting and kind of creative in some way. So we took this JPEG of Walter Benjamin, who wrote an essay about art in the age of mechanical reproduction. So we thought, back in the 30s, when there was a debate whether photography is art or not, and we had the robot try to create a portrait, to paint it oil on canvas, to see if it can actually make something interesting and interpretive of that thing. And it came up with lots of interesting designs, lots of different ways. This is all oil on canvas, and other kind of pictures. And the way it works is very similar to what I showed you before. It starts off with a random painting in its head inside the simulator and gradually breeds that painting internally through millions of variations until it matches up with the JPEG that it's trying to paint. And so from an artist's point of view, the question is now, how does it match up? What's the metric you use to decide whether something internal matches up with reality? And so that kind of elevates or changes. It's kind of a new medium where, as an artist, you play around with these criteria rather than actually holding the paintbrush in your hand. So here's an example where we said, here's the picture. You only have two paints. Paint it. And also paint it with only 50 or 20 strokes, no more. And that it came up with these two pictures, which I think are kind of pretty interesting and kind of impressionistic, if you like. And here are a few more paints, and here are drawings and so forth. So we sent that into an exhibition at Harvard, and they were going to show it, and then at the last minute they canceled. And they said, well, actually we're not sure it's art because it's a machine, and it's too controversial. So I think I thought that would be a good reason to put it in there, but it wasn't. So, but I want to move away from art and talk in the end on designing actual physical objects. And somebody mentioned 3D printing and how it's changing everything and who's designing and what people are designing and so forth. We have our own open source 3D printer project, Fab at Home. This is the Model 1, the Model 2. There's been hundreds of these built. This is an open source $800 do-it-yourself kit for making a 3D printer. People have been using it to make all kinds of things, including food. This is a printed cookie. And if you cut it in two, you'll see inside. So I think on a side note that food is through 3D printing what gaming was for computers, this frivolous application. Who would use a mainframe to do gaming? It's mainframe computers are only for military calculations and payroll, right? So that's where that is going. But let's talk about designing shapes. So there's a lot of work on CAD systems, computer-aided design systems for engineers, and that's been where the primary users of design tools, mechanical design tools up until now, but increasingly with the availability of these easy-to-use, low-end rapid prototyping machines, more and more people want to design. And they don't necessarily have engineering skills. In fact, the vast majority of them do not have engineering training, and yet they want to design. So there's a lot of interesting opportunities and new ideas how to allow people without engineering training to design circuits, to design software, to design shapes, to do all these kinds of interesting things. This is an experiment we recently did called Endless Forms. It's on endlessforms.com. It's a way to allow people to design without knowing anything about engineering. All it does, it starts with showing you a bunch of random shapes, and you have in your head that you want to design I don't know, a martini glass, okay? And so you say, I like this, I don't like that, I don't like that. The machine looks at your selections, tries to figure out what you like and what you don't like. It generates a new generation and so forth. And over a couple of iterations, you get interesting things. This is an example of somebody designing a lampshade, a lamp, and you can see how the machine hones in into the fact that they like kind of these shapes, but it's exploring, you know, square, round, I don't know, shagginess. It's coming up with all these different attributes, which are very difficult to quantify ahead of time. But when the machine can see what users are selecting, it's beginning to hone in on that. So you can imagine how that could influence design or user-led design for everything from, you know, shapes of cars and so forth to all kinds of directions. So you can, of course, click the print button. And if you swipe your credit card, you can get it in almost any material on Shapeways, from silver to bronze. This is a bronze butterfly. This is this lamp thing and so forth. So people are making all kinds of things in lots of different ways. High school kids have classes about design. Again, they don't need to know anything about engineering. But we're taking this one step further now, allowing people to start off with some design that they scan from something, and then have the machine create variations of it, and then they can choose that and take that forward. We also want to make it even more easy to design, so you don't even have to click. You sit back and relax, and where your eyeballs look at, that's what gets evolved. And it's really interesting to see people use that, and suddenly the shapes that they like or dislike begin to grow in the system. The last thing I want to talk about is this idea of a matter compiler, which is another kind of direction that's going more for the high-end engineering. So the kind of the ordinary people who do not have engineering background want to design lots of things, but then you have high-trained engineers who want to design more and more increasingly sophisticated things. And we want to have something where you can say, here are my constraints, I want the bracket that holds this, this is the volume. You hit enter, the machine evolves shapes and gives you the optimal solution. Here's an example, how it works, here's a shape, it's harnessed, it's loaded. Give me the optimal solution. The machine, this is real time, runs and analyzes it and gives you an optimal cantilever beam that can support the load as you requested. And these are sort of tools that are that compile your high-level requirements into something low-end. And you can say, I want it again, but this time I want to leave this space empty just because that's what I want. And the machine obeys and finds a solution that leaves that space empty. So lots of directions to go like that. Here's it is working in 3D. So the idea that eventually, this is an illustration, but the idea is that eventually this mechanical design combined with electronic design and software, you know, this is, I don't know, 50 years ahead, will be at the point where you just say what you want, you hit enter, the machine designs it automatically to your specification. It might show you a couple of things to see what you like and what you don't like when it comes to aesthetics. And then it makes it automatically on demand. And I think really that's where this thing is going. All right, so we know that a monkey evolution cannot produce Shakespeare, but it's interesting that it can ask questions and it can produce designs. And the question is, where is all of this going? And I wanna end with this quote that appeared in the New York Times just recently. Theoretical physicists are not yet obsolete, but scientists have taken steps towards replacing themselves. This appeared about a work just recently, and I think that's very far from the truth. What is happening are two things. On one end, we have people without engineering training, without design training, that are able to design and make things that just 10 years ago would be state-of-the-art design. On the other end of the spectrum, we have trained people who, using these tools of creative and curious machines, can design much more and farther than could ever before. Thank you.
All right. I just wanted to let you all know that Hod's going to be available to take questions at the break. And also, I feel bad saying this in front of Hod, but the robot that teaches itself to move really frightens me. And I can't even leave my Roomba on in my house while I'm away because I'm scared it's going to take over the world, and he's proving me right. So I just wanted to say that. So let's give a big round of applause for Hod. I want to invite our second alumni panel up to the stage now. This way. Or that way. Okay. So just to give you an idea of what this alumni panel, the thought behind it, it's focused on experiential and media design, and we'll look at current trends in user experience research and design. Going beyond today, the panel will also examine what is on the horizon for human-computer interaction and how this field will increasingly shape our world. So I'm going to welcome our panelists. I'm going to start on the end with Phil King. Phil, say hello.
Hi.
Phil is the Director of Product Design at Flickr, where he specializes in user experience, team leadership, and product design for web, mobile, and desktop apps. Phil manages a cross-functional user experience team at Flickr, the largest and most vibrant photo enthusiast community in the world. Previously, he managed a user experience team and led the product design strategy for eBay's diverse consumer and professional sellers. Next to him, we have Samantha Berg. She's an interaction designer who most recently served as senior interaction designer and design lead for Palm's suite of communication apps, as well as an active designer in the effort to evolve WebOS into a multi-product platform. Outside of work, Samantha is co-chair for the Cornell Alumni Admissions Ambassador Network in San Francisco and reunion co-chair for the class of 2009. Next, we have Keeman Sinteris, a software engineer who joined Facebook last year when they acquired his venture, Push Pop Press, a digital books innovator that served as the medium for Al Gore's book, Our Choice. David Pogue of the New York Times called the book one of the most elegant, fluid, impressive apps you've ever seen. It's a showpiece for the new world of touchscreen gadgets. Next to him, we have Jeff Hawkins, co-founder of Numenta, a venture aimed at developing a new approach to machine intelligence through a learning algorithm that automatically finds patterns in streams of data and predicts what is likely to occur next. Jeff is also the co-founder of both Handspring and Palm, and co-creator of the Palm Pilot and Handspring Trio. Next to him, we have Laura Grunka. She's a user experience research lead and manager for Google Plus, where she develops research strategy, conducts research, and manages a team of UX designers and researchers working in the social space. Prior to Google Plus, she spent 6 years working on Google Search, improving the user experience of products such as Social Search, the Plus One button, Google Instant, and Google Suggest. Lastly, we have Dane Glasgow. He's the Vice President of Global Product Management for eBay Marketplaces. Dane joined eBay in 2008 when it acquired Positronic, a data mining startup that he co-founded. While at Cornell, Dane launched Jump.com, an internet-based email and calendar service that was acquired by Microsoft in 1999. And I think, Phil, you worked on that as well, didn't you?
Sure yeah. Did.
Okay. Dane didn't want me to read this, but I'm going to embarrass him anyway. Dane was recently named the 2011 40 Under 40 Rising Star by the Silicon Valley Business Journal and will serve as our moderator. So I'll turn it over to Dane, who now is very mad at me.
Awesome. So I figured we'd just jump right in and by way of introduction, maybe start with an easy question, which is how did everybody get involved in user experience? And so maybe we'll start with Phil and then just work our way down.
Thanks. So as Ashley mentioned, my real first job was my junior year at Cornell. I got hired at Jump, which had started and was really getting rolling. That was kind of a part-time gig where I learned what design really was outside of the comm department where I was taking a lot of classes. After the acquisition by Microsoft, I started looking around for the next thing to do and helped start a company and did that all through my senior year with basically a bunch of friends. We rented the space right next to the Royal Palms to hear shutting down, which is a real hits me there. But had an awesome experience basically building product while taking classes. It was really, really a good time. So moved to California, and I've done a lot of work since getting here, but it was really a great start, just kind of learning and working at the same time.
Cool. Sam?
I got into user experience, and specifically into mobile user experience, because I had a really bad cell phone that I hated using every day. And as a younger person who lives their entire life on their cell phone, that was just unacceptable to me. So I kind of said, okay, like this just isn't working. I need to fix this. And while I was at school, I interned at Motorola working on their mobile devices and then accepted a position with Palm straight out of school, and I've been there since.
Awesome. I actually was kind of born into it. My mom is a graphic designer. My dad is a nuclear engineer turned computer hobbyist. And as I was growing up, I watched the Commodore get replaced by the Amiga, get replaced by the Amstrad, or excuse me, the Mac. And it was really interesting to see design applied to computing to the point where then computers became tools for designers. And it kind of took working at Apple to kind of really solidify my professional experience in the field. But it was an amazing experience.
So I'm not a user interface designer, and I don't want to be one, but I'm really a brain researcher, and I'm working on neuroscience and machine intelligence. But for a while in my life, I couldn't do that, so I had to do something else, and so I started Palm, because I, like the other panelists here, I'm really frustrated with computers. I don't like gadgets, and I had to use a computer, and it really stunk. And I said, boy, we can't build billions of these for people in the world. We have to build something simpler. And that's when we started Palm, and it had to solve many user interface problems at that time just to make a very simple, easy-to-use device that was low cost.
I got into user experience research much from one of my mentors from Cornell, Professor Jerry Gay. Was really an inspiration to me. I worked in her computer-human interaction lab for my master's degree. And I was funded on a grant that she got to use an eye tracker. And she had just gotten the eye tracker, and she said, Laura, just do something cool with this eye tracker. And I said, what is an eye tracker? What is eye tracking? And so from that, in 2002, there was a lot less web-based eye tracking than we have now. So I ended up partnering with a computer science professor, and we basically used eye tracking to help inform the ranking for search results in terms of how people view and select search results and in the order they do so. And so from there, I went to Google and did some search quality work. And then from there, became a user experience researcher.
Cool. And just for what how I got involved, I actually got started back in high school doing digital video production back on 1X CD-ROMs, which was cutting-edge technology at the time, and getting videos to play off of those, and that's sort of how I got started in user experience. So just to sort of get into the topic, when you think back over the past, say, 10 years, what are some of the biggest advances and biggest changes in user experience that everybody's encountered? And maybe we'll start with Sam.
Seen in user experience, even just in the last 5 years, has really just been this acceptance of user experience and of design. And the fact that it's something that needs to be looked out for, needs to be accounted for, and really needs to be prioritized. When I was interning and when I was still in school, it was very obvious that companies didn't really care about this and that they cared more about just getting a product that was functional and pushing it out the door, getting it out on time. And the user was really a last priority. And now I think it's pretty incredible. It's just become very mainstream that you need to do design first. There needs to be research. You need to understand your users and what they're looking for and really make that the number one priority.
Awesome. Anybody else got something to add on that, Keeman? Or?
Sure. I would say probably one of the more interesting things that has happened in the last decade or so is touch-enabled interfaces, direct manipulation with your computers. I think that's kind of a paradigm shift. I think it's helped make computing a lot more accessible, and created a whole new set of design problems and challenges for people to solve. Touch-enabled devices.
Well, you know, I'm uniquely on this panel because I'm a lot older than everybody else. But, you know, that's what we said back in 1982 when the Mac came out. You know, it's interesting how things turn around. You know, that was the whole point back then with the graphic user interface was it manipulating, you know, objects on the screen. Of course, you didn't use your finger, but you used the mouse, but it was the same idea. So the ideas recycle around, but you know, it's qualitatively different, but not, I should say it's quantitatively different, but not qualitatively different from what happened back then.
Yeah. I would follow that up, though, and say that the interaction with the computer is becoming more and more direct, and I think that one-to-one interaction with your computer is actually a bit of a game changer. So I think we've minimized the delta, the you know artificial kind of model, to the point where it's become one-to-one. Mm. But
well, that's when we get the brain implants, but we'll talk about
sure,
that later.
Sure. Lots more to come.
I also say it's the use of the screen. So you talk about you know directly manipulating objects, whether it's with your finger or with mouse. But previously, right, you used to think of your monitor as a very static rectangle. Right now, your mobile phones can be scrolled vertically, horizontally. They can be dragged around. And I think that's one of the biggest you know advancements that mobile has brought for us.
I'd love to build off of that and just say that I think that the more that people are able to directly manipulate their devices and really get into this relationship with their device, it becomes a very personal relationship that I think really didn't exist before. Like Laura was saying, you kind of just thought of, you know, your device as like a cold piece of hardware that's sitting there, and when you turn it on, it's doing something for you. But now I think people are really almost having this like weird love affair with their devices, and that like this is something that they use every day. This is really helping them, and they're feeling very personal about it.
So that brings us to an important topic, which is obviously mobile technology has seriously affected the user experience and has become sort of the primary way that many folks are interacting with products and services. How have you guys seen sort of that affect user experience design when you think about the mobile device? You know, obviously, there's different challenges. You have a PC, you got high precision input to some extent with being able to select a pixel with a cursor versus a very large set of pixels with your finger. And so I'm just curious, like how has that affected some of the work that you guys have done? Does anybody want to start with that one?
Sure. What's obviously different with the mobile or tablet, right? You have size, as we've all said. And so what does size do? It means it's portable. You can carry it around. So that makes location-aware and location-sensitive types of things a lot more compelling and usable on a mobile phone. So mobile phones can more easily triangulate. If you're doing something on a mobile, we already have some context where you are, what you might want. Right? And then, as we've already alluded to, there's touch screens, you can directly manipulate the space. And I remember working with designers in 2005, and 1024 by 768 was a huge, you know, burden for you. You hated designing for that size on a desktop, right? But now we've moved to the mobile phones, and even though the screens are even smaller, there's a lot of more creative solutions for using that space.
Well, a few years ago, a couple friends started talking about this. The idea of designing mobile first. It used to be that you know you'd be working on a product and you're starting a company and you would try to design out this very intricate thing, you know, loads of functionality, and you're trying to fit it all into a space on your big 1024 by 768 screen, which is so enormous by today's standards. And the idea of going mobile first, at least for me, and the way I think about it, is that you're trying to get to more of a minimum viable product now. Certainly, you're always trying to get into the market more quickly, but you need to distill down, you know, what can I actually fit into this app that people are going to be using on their Android phone or iPhone or whatever. So this idea of kind of reducing and removing clutter, simplifying. And the other part of it is that's even maybe more interesting is thinking about the context that people are using these devices in. Instead of just assuming that somebody's going to be at best sitting with their laptop, but probably sitting at a desk at home, and they have some task in mind. Now, you know, there's a lot of apps it's my Elmer Fudd moment. A lot of apps out there that are. You know, how am I going to help this person waste time while they're sitting at the bus stop? Or this person's at the grocery store, and how am I going to help remind them, even just thinking, like, I know that this person's at the grocery store and they haven't told me, what do I need to remind them about? You know, what's their shopping list without them having to go look for it or whatever. So this kind of geo-awareness and much more kind of contextual design that's going on, that's pretty awesome. And it's really makes design even more fun.
I definitely agree with that, that mobile has forced a strict adherence to, you know, what is the most important elements of your application, of your user interface. I also really think that it's just enabled this whole new set of applications, right? And that your testing matrix, you're no longer talking about testing your computer and your user interface that you built at your, you know, office desk. You're talking about testing it, you know, your iPod on the treadmill, you know, at the gym, or your iPad laying in bed. I think, you know, there's a number of much more interesting and different set of challenges when it comes to design when building everyday computer products.
Yeah, I think that because they're everyday computer products, you also have a much larger range of people and of users who are using these products. And people are not picking up user manuals to sit here and read for 3 days about how to use their devices. They want to just turn it on and start using it immediately. So I know Phil had mentioned simplicity before, but I think it also just boils down to like simplicity for the user in terms of you have, you know, a baby who's sitting there trying to play a game on the phone and be entertained during dinner, and then you have, you know, an 85-year-old woman who's using it, you know, somewhere else, and you need to design for all of that and just have it be something that people can pick up. So I think it's really, really forcing designers to make things simple. I think that's a big plus in the industry right now.
Yeah, one of the things that I'd add is that at eBay, for example, we see a ton of our customers using multiple devices. So they're using their iPhone while they're in a meeting trying to bid on something. They're on their tablet while they're watching TV. They're on their laptop while they're traveling. They're on their home PC when they get home. And to some extent, that experience that they're having is one experience, but it's cutting across multiple devices. And each of those devices has like its own set of really cool capabilities, but they don't all match up. So, you know, the iPhone's pretty cool for taking a picture of an item and easily listing it on the site. But if you're trying to do a large amount of transaction work, a PC has some advantages. And so I think one of the things that we see when it comes to mobile and thinking about the experience is really catering and crafting that experience to the device and the capabilities while maintaining a consistent experience across multiple devices. And that's definitely one of the big opportunities I see ahead.
I think that also ties into what John had said in the earlier panel about ecosystems and how the next big thing is really people developing these entire ecosystems that can stretch across multiple devices, multiple types of devices. And that way you can kind of do everything at once and have it act the right way at the right time.
Awesome. Okay, so let's talk about the future. What do you guys see as the next big thing in user experience and design? Jeff, you wanna lead us off?
Sure. I see two things that you might think are contradictory. One is I'm more interested in really great user interface design showing up on other types of products. I see there's a tremendous opportunity more so in things that are not mobile phones or tablets and so on. And someone in the previous panel mentioned thermostats. I didn't know. I'm surprised they weren't aware of the Nest thermostat. It's a beautiful product. It doesn't have a touch panel on it. It has a completely different type of interface, but beautifully done. It's going to be amazingly successful. I've already bought four of them. And that's one direction. We need to have, you know, great UI design. That's just not another smartphone. We need it in our cars. We need it on devices. I have a controller for my pool at home, which is just terrible. It's unbelievable. You know, they built something so sucky as that. But moving that paradigm of really great design into other types of devices. On the other hand, I think, you know, as we go to the world of Internet of Things, where we have billions and billions of devices that are collecting data and doing stuff, we don't want to put a user interface on them. So another big trend I see is actually getting rid of user interfaces on products. You know, people have talked about about for years, like a refrigerator, like, wow, we're going to have this interface in the refrigerator, let you control baloney. A refrigerator shouldn't have anything. It should be really smart. It should be connected. It should be making itself more efficient on its own. And we shouldn't be trying to improve the user interface. We should be trying to remove the user interface from that. So these sort of two things, the things we really do need to interact with the world beyond your cell phone, need to be much, much better and cleaner design, things like thermostats and so on. And you know, on the other hand, I think we need to be doing things with sort of analytics and intelligence to get rid of the interface of devices.
Got it. Kim, you want to?
Yeah, following up on thermostats, it's actually true. It's a very, very good example. So I think the most recent breakthrough was touch-enabled devices. I think the next one is going to be touchless devices. So basically devices that are sensor-based, and Nest is actually, the learning thermostat is actually a really good example. Siri is another. The Xbox Kinect is also one. And if people are kind of interested in taking a peek into the future, I would highly recommend an ad called The Kinect Effect, which basically kind of projects what an Xbox Kinect could be like in the future. And it is all hands-free, just user interfaces that are much more integrated with your everyday life.
Cool. Anybody else? One other thing I saw recently that I thought was pretty interesting is the OLED proliferation of screens. You think about the next generation of display technology and how smart it's going to be is pretty interesting because, you know, all of a sudden they're starting to show transparent displays and flexible displays. And so the idea of the types of interfaces that you want to create for that could go in a lot of different directions. I saw a pretty interesting prototype recently where it had a transparent screen and you were able to stick your hands in and be typing and manipulate the data underneath the screen because you can interact with it. And so, you know, as those things come out, you know, we don't know. It's hard to know which ones of those will catch on as really interesting changes. But the reality is that the display technology and the intelligence and the capabilities of the devices is improving so rapidly that you really can do a lot more things than you used to be able to. Cool. So let's talk a little bit about analytics. So, you know, when I came out to the Valley, I would say there was a pretty strong aesthetic design sense, and people would think really hard about what looked right or discuss the philosophy of the right button and the right placement. But over time, data has really become a major tool in the evolution of user experience. I'm curious, when people think about that change, what are they seeing and how that sort of changes the way we work in user experience and what kinds of things has that meant for your work? I don't know. Laura, Jeff, Phil.
Sure. So research is essentially informing design a lot more than it used to. And so this doesn't necessarily mean that it's slowing things down, but design is structured such that research is baked into that process. And so when we talk about analytics or user experience research, there's kind of, let's just be on the same page about all the different kinds of research there is. So everything from logs and behaviors, what people are doing, you know, there's surveys and, you know, market trends, and then there's pure usability about how are people actually using your product, you know, what's intuitive, what's not, can people navigate, and the same thing on competitors. And so different stages of research fit in at all different parts of the process. And so in that way, design is it can be more informed in terms of how it iterates. If you have analytics data showing that nobody clicks and uses your feature, you can take a step back and say, okay, is this feature just crap, or is it actually nobody seeing it, and can we design the interface a little bit better such that this feature, what we think is probably useful, might get more use?
Cool. Anybody else seen changes in the way they work? You can get a little closer to him.
Sorry. Two things. One part of research that I really valuable or find really valuable is helping discover what users are going to really like interacting with or what features they're going to value. And this is everything from very informal, like just using a lot of products or reading discussion forums online, things like that, and also a lot of research that teams do and share with us. That helps you throughout the whole cycle. The kind of more analytical side of things is interesting. You know, the Google example earlier of let's test out 40 shades of blue. I've I've kind of gone back and forth on how much I like that. I really like testing to learn how successful something is, but you can only find the best bad answer to problems that way. Blue might not have been a good style choice in the first place at any shade, you know, for Google to go with, but you're not going to find that out by testing. And that, I think, you know, when Dude quit Google about that and wrote that piece, it was kind of like, yeah, that's just the wrong way to be working. And I think that stifles a lot of kind of really creative thinking. But at the same time, you have companies like Netflix and Amazon and these guys who are doing good research and having good ideas, but then also testing them all out and see how well they stick. And they can look at numbers on that and help choose. But I think, at least from what I've seen at those companies, they're also putting a lot of priority on their gut and recognizing a good idea versus discarding ones that might test well but just aren't good for their product.
Cool. So, go ahead.
I was just going to follow it up and say that, yes, I think analytics have their place. And I've worked for companies that believe in analytics and companies that don't believe in analytics. I think one thing that you can't undervalue is that initial user experience. I liken like the first interaction with your application or your product as kind of like unwrapping a Christmas present. And that first experience, like at least at Pushpop, what we found the most valuable was basically just handing somebody an iPhone or an iPad and just watching them and just seeing what evoked an emotional reaction. I don't know if analytics sufficiently can capture that or places enough emphasis on that initial experience.
I'm curious what you say when you mean believe in analytics, because analytics, they're numbers and they're generally real if you're logging things appropriately. And so do you mean that, you know, people just disregard them? Is that what you mean by believe?
No, I think, like Phil said, it's very easy to get stuck in a local minimum,
by the way,
where basically you're just, you know, pixel tweaking, but not actually taking a step back and really thinking of the problem that you might be trying to solve. My current company also believes in analytics very heavily.
So. Well, my current company, that's what we're doing, analytics, so I believe in it. I believe. But, you know, related to another thing, the most poignant experience I had when I was designing user interfaces was this out of, I don't know if they still call it this, but the out-of-box experience. And still few people do this, which is you have to give your product to someone, hopefully in as raw form as possible. So don't take it out of the wrapping. Don't even take it off the shelf. You observe them in the store if you can. And then you watch them try to use the product, and you're not allowed to say anything. And it's the most painful thing you've ever done. You think you've made the most beautiful thing, and you think it's the most amazing design, whatever it is, and you see that people can't even figure out which way to get the plastic off, which way it opens up, they can't get the box open, the screw falls on the floor, they didn't even notice it. It's unbelievable. That is, if I were, one thing I learned in user interface design, the most important thing to do is to just, behind a mirror, if you will, it will, watch someone try to use your product, and you can't help them. Yeah. It really is a wake-up call.
It's interesting because it's really important as the company or service grows, because it's very easy to fall into the trap of doing A/B tests, looking at the data for your existing customers, looking at like how you're evolving the experience, and it's easy to kind of get trapped to some extent looking at that data because that's the data that you have, and taking a step back and really looking at that first-time customer experience is always important because it's always changing as you evolve your product.
I'm building a little bit off of what Jeff was saying. I think it's really easy also when you talk about, you know, user experience and design to really just think of design in the sense of the product itself, but not how it translates to other things. So you design a really fabulous product, but then marketing and sales and stuff, those also need to reflect the design that you did. They need to reflect what the bigger values are. And I mean, you watch users trying to take a product out of the box, and it's really painful to watch. What's even more painful is watching them walk right by the box, because the box doesn't actually say anything about the hard work that you put into this or about the good design that you think you've done, and people are never going to experience
it. It's more painful watching them trying to use it, I think. But, you know, one is the other one's just disappointment. Why do they walk past? But just making fun. Yes, you're right.
But really, you know, looking at user experience as a holistic approach to a product, not just the actual product, but, you know, yeah, everything that goes into that product and selling it and getting it out to market.
Awesome. So let's talk about another area. We talk about research. So obviously user experience research has grown in its importance in the Valley and in a number of companies here. And to some extent, research of all kinds has sort of applied in different ways in different companies. I'm curious how you guys think about research when it comes to user experience and how best to apply it.
So I found research, short answer from a researcher is it depends, but research is applicable kind of at all stages of the product development. And so we've done a lot of early stage research for questions as broad as, okay, we know bookmarking can be better, you know, how can we make it better? And so kind of understanding about how people store and collect information, bookmark things now, and where are those pain points and where can we improve them? Those kinds of early insights can help direct a product vision at the early stage. And at the middle stage of a product development, that's kind of when the most feature creep can come in, because people kind of know what direction you're going in, and you know, engineers and developers are brilliant, and they can throw in any feature they want, and so research can really help you refine and hone the direction and the importance, the relative importance of feature functionality. And then finally, hopefully it's before you think you're completely polished, but you do want to assess the usability of the whole out-of-box experience. How are people using the product? And hopefully it's at a stage when you can still make enough iterations and changes to improve that.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Anybody else have anything to add on that? How they apply research at their companies or...
That's a pretty good summary.
That's a pretty good summary? So, I mean, I guess the other thing I'd say is that... I'd add that I think related to the last question, it's easy to get into analytics and data as your primary tool for research. And I would really caution everyone to stay away from that being your only tool of input. And I know a number of folks I've interacted with often sort of gravitate to that. And a lot of us sort of have an engineering background or started engineering, so data's fun and data's the thing that's really interesting. But sitting down and talking to customers is really, really important. And especially at that beginning phase, having that opportunity to really connect with your customers and talk about the challenges they see in your product and talk about the things that they're looking for gives you some really great inspiration that you'll likely never get from data alone.
And I'd also add that it helps you better interpret the logs you're getting. Yeah. I'm always reminded of this study about banner blindness from 1999. And basically, they did an experiment where they asked people to find, they asked people a question, and they gave them a web page to find the answer. And half the times, the answer was in this really blinking, bright, colorful ad-looking thing at the top of the page. And it was the exact answer they needed. But in those cases, when it wasn't written in the text of the page, people completely didn't say, oh, I give up, I can't find it, right? And if you were just looking at logs in that case, you'd say, oh, okay, well, I wonder what we should do. Maybe we should build a bigger, brighter, blinkier banner, right? Unless you actually talk to people and see how they're actually viewing and using the interface. You don't really know what the problem is.
Got it. All right, so I think we're gonna start opening it up very shortly here to audience questions. So as you guys start to formulate those. We'll conclude with one question. I'm curious. We've all had different experiences at different companies. How do you see design being valued at a company, and what role do you think it should play at the company? Not necessarily what it does play, but sort of what do you think the role of design should be in the user experience?
Design in general, design and user experience.
User experience. Oh.
I think you're seeing it a little bit here. I mean, it's funny to be on a panel like this with a bunch of designers, and we're all building on each other's ideas and conversations happening and moving along. And that's a big part about what I think my job is, and I'm lucky enough to be part of a company where it's just no question. You know, I'm part of the leadership team for the product I work on, and that's the way it's always been, and it's probably the way it'll always be. Maybe not me. But it's hopefully we get conversations going, and we help people, you know, digest what they're saying in three different ways and feedback, like, I think you're saying this, is this what you actually want? And it, you know, it ties back into the research that we all do with, you know, before we start designing a product in the first place is, you know, it's not my job to do what users are asking for. It's, you know, it's to figure out what the people in the room or whoever I'm watching want, or what's going to make their life better, what's going to make my product more successful, what's going to make the company more successful or whatever, and then take action on that and convince people. So it's a lot of kind of listening and communication and things like that, as much as pixel pushing.
I'll pick up on that one. I'm not sure it answers your question, but I'll pick up on that one. I agree with you 100% on this. What I've learned over the years when you're designing something is you actually, users tell you what they want, but they're almost always wrong.
Yeah.
What you have to do is observe what they want. They won't tell you this. So they will say this and they'll say that, but you have to watch them, and they'll actually, their actions will belie what really is the problem, what really is going on. So it's kind of funny. You ask them questions and then you kind of ignore what they say, but you just observe them. And I found that over and over and over again, that's a great way of about going things. You need to get them to talk and act and interact, but don't trust what they say. You have to get below the surface there. That's one of the keys of designing anything, I think, is to be able to dig below that surface of what is caught. Because people will tell you what they think what you want to hear, or what they've read in the paper, or they've read in some journal. Oh, I'm supposed to say this, but then you watch them and you see, no, that's not what they want.
This is the fascinating part about this is the whole day about the Nest thermostat. It doesn't do what you ask it to. Like when you say, I'm cold, make the room warmer, it doesn't. And you turn the thermostat all the way up. Humans are terrible at this. Every conference room I've ever been in is either too hot or too cold because it's pinned one way or the other. So you say, I want to be warmer, and it makes the room a little bit warmer, but it doesn't crank it up to 95 and shoot way past where you want to be. And it learns from that in cycles. There's no direct interaction with that. And it's not doing what you say you want. It's doing what you need.
I would just follow that up and build on that by just saying that in my mind, design and engineering are actually not that dissimilar. They're both about solving problems, and I've kind of had experience with both fields. Design is really about solving user problems, and I actually think that needs to start the product development process.
Yeah, I would certainly, I'll answer my own question, but I think it's really important to have design in the room right from the beginning. When you're approaching the problem space, I have found, at least in my career, that having the design in the room and having that voice as a part of the journey has been tremendously valuable in evolving the process.
So I'm going to share an experience which is outside of user interface design, right? So I work at a company now that I founded 7 years ago, and we do this like really mathy neuroscience modeling stuff, and all the employees are very technical. And there's no user interface to our product. And I was telling them I was coming here today, and they said, well, that's okay. I said, what should I say about user interface design? They said, well, API design, everybody know API is application programmers interface. API design is the new UI design. And this is a buzzword that's going around in technologists these days. What they're saying is essentially that the principles of UI design, where we're just talking about here, actually now are flowing down into the more technical API designs and products, and ideas of RESTful APIs and things like that are in this format. So the whole idea of design and designing a product, the point of this is actually moving down into the very technical engineering aspects as well, where people think at the same things we did about UI design, we're thinking up front about API design and how the programmer is going to interact with the product. And of course, it meant that we're trying to remove all the user interfaces in the world. But besides that, anyway, it's an interesting idea, I thought.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'd say the other thing I've seen a lot lately is more and more crossover designers. So great designers who are also great front-end engineers, yeah, who can really evolve a prototype of a concept very quickly. We've been running some experiments inside of eBay called pre-visualization, where before we even get involved in a particular area or invest in it heavily, we actually get a bunch of designers, some engineers, some product managers in a room, and we just riff on an idea for days, and actually we'll test the concept in prototype form every night, just to evolve the idea and to sort of see what works and what doesn't. And that kind of intense period allows us to evolve things pretty fast. Okay, so we got some questions in the audience. All right.
Yeah, hi, thank you. First off, I work as a DBA, a database administrator, so I'm glad that at least some of you believe in analytics. but my question is more about consumer and how I recently purchased a Roku device, right, the network streaming device for the TV. And I was floored when I turned it on, and I didn't even have my code off, just like you've been talking about, plugged it all into my router and turned it on and signed up, linked up my either Amazon or Netflix, one of those accounts, and it started my movie right where I had left it off, on my Mac from the night before. And I thought, well, that works. So my question is about statefulness. And, you talked about knowing where I am, but, do you know who I'm with, or do you know what time of day it is, and how might that inform the design process?
I saw a neat thing the other day, which is like this portable doorbell that is an app on the iPhone. Provided that it actually works, it's fascinating. So it keeps track of, well, when you fire up the app anyway, it keeps track of where you are. It knows that you're walking up close to a friend's house, and when you push the doorbell button, it sends them a text message to let them know that you're there. And it's like, my head blew up, you know, when thinking about that. It's like, wow, I don't even have to call anybody anymore, and I don't have to look up the contact. And it all just happens. And that's, I mean, it's not the statefulness that you're talking about, but it's a bit more than the contextualness that we talked about earlier.
You know, I'm not sure everyone is the same thought about these issues. Some people, and myself included, I want more privacy from my mobile devices. And I like to be more in control of my world, and I don't want to be interrupted as much, and I don't really want my smartphone to be smart. I want it to be very, very capable. But if you've ever had a personal assistant or something, there's nothing worse than someone doing something even once in 100 times that you didn't ask it to do, and it can be really annoying. So. Some of us actually don't want that. You know, I don't want my phone knowing where I am. If I ask it to, and I say, I want you to tell me now, you know, okay, I'm navigating my car, do something about that. But other than that, you know, I'm not into like letting everybody know where I'm at and hanging out. So, and I don't think I'm unusual about it. There's quite a few people who really want that separation. They really want a separation from the digital world.
Wouldn't it be nice though if everybody's phone in the room like silenced itself when you walked in here? Like, that would be smart to me. Like,
yeah, it would be smart, but maybe there's a doctor who's about to, you know, who can't have that. I don't know, you know, and then someone dies, and then you know.
On to more uplifting topics. Okay. No one die, okay? All right. Who's next?
Yeah, just to build off of that, how do you balance the need for getting more research on the user experience and balancing the user's privacy?
So can you repeat the question? You're talking about user research and privacy. Sorry.
I just mean for the greater good, gathering information on how people use products, but protecting those users' privacy. Is there any conflict there, or how do you deal with that?
Yeah, pretty much any company that I know really, or at least that's a public company, will sanitize logs, so everything is completely confidential. And any users that you test with, you know, everything is fully confidential. You know, stripped of any personally identifying information. Is that what you're referring to?
You know, you see Facebook and Google, I mean, it's been all of the headlines and how they deal with user privacy and how, you know, you want your, some people want their devices to know a lot about them and be smart, but like you said, Jeff,
I think we could do a lot better job of opting in and opting out. You know, Google changed their privacy policies recently, and they had this really nice thing, we really care that you read this, and really, did you read it? I couldn't read it, it was a bunch of gobbledygook. And, you know, so it's like saying, do you want to donate your organs? But, you know, I won't tell you the conditions on which you're going to do this. And so I think we should just do a much, much better job of opting in and opting out clearly. I find continually frustrated in products that don't do that. They'll let you click or not click, but you can't really find out what the hell's going on. It's a bunch of legalese. And you'll find that people, many, many, many people want to opt in. They want to contribute. A lot of people just want to do that.
What's the difference between opting in and signing out?
What's the difference? Well, signing, I mean, we're just talking about specifically about sharing my data. That's what I'm referring about, sharing my data. So I sign in to use a product. That doesn't mean I want to share my experience with someone else. That's what I was referring to that.
Yeah.
Okay. We're talking specifically about sharing data amongst other people.
I think in a number of cases, you'll see companies actually proactively ask for your permission to collect data to improve the customer experience. And in my career, I've seen certainly a larger uptick of users who opt into those programs than you would expect. And so that's one way in that you can sort of provide the privacy and obfuscate the experience as well.
I just argued that they don't do a good enough job because I can't always tell, like, what's it actually going to be used for? Will I start getting emails from this? Will someone blah, 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 you know? So often you do that stuff and you make up fake email addresses and phone numbers or whatever you have to do to get past things.
We're learning a lot about Jeff.
I would just like to say that, you know, as any company collecting data, like, needs to be, you know, considered like a very grave kind of matter. And I think it really all needs to kind of come back to the product. Like, will you be able to build a better product with this data? And I think that is like has to be the guiding principle. So, you know, whether state is shared across all your devices, and you know, when you go back to your, you know, phone and you can pick up the movie right where you left off, like, I think there's like an element of least surprise. That's actually what you want your smart device to do. And, you know, making that happen is a good thing. And if that means, you know, sharing data, I think the user does want that.
Yeah, I brought up the signing in issue just because people have brought up the issue of multiple devices already, and that's something that is really helpful on multiple devices. So, you know, if you're doing a search on your computer, say someone's coming in to visit and they've never been to In-N-Out, so you're going to pick them up from the airport and go to the closest In-N-Out, and you search for that and you plan out the route on your desktop, and then you're in your car and your phone doesn't know what all that hard work you did, right? I mean, that's the kind of thing where having a device independent but account dependent sort of system is where enabling your data to be used in that way would be really helpful for a lot of users.
Kindle does a pretty good job of this too, you know, yeah. If you're tracking where you are in books and so on.
Yep. Okay, next question. We're over there, okay?
Yeah. Hello. Not to beat the privacy thing on the head, but I want to take an exception to one thing that Laura said, which is that if I'm in the grocery store looking at the ice cream aisle 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week, and it gives me an ad for ice cream or an ad for an ice cream, stopping program from my healthcare provider, and I click on that ad, and they now have my cookie linked to the fact that I love a lot of ice cream, it's not obvious to me that I'm telling my healthcare provider at that ad point where I'm about to get $10 off my ice cream bulk purchase that that's going to increase my healthcare costs later because they now know that I'm obese or I'm more likely to be obese. So one of the things that, for me, is also an older person, older than all but Jeff, sorry. But one of the things that I remember from the 90s, way back when, was people were deathly afraid of using credit card information online because they didn't know where it was. So it became a user interface problem to put that lock there and reinforce, okay, this is an okay place where you can put your credit card. How important is it for the user interface in the future, which is what this panel is about, to be more upfront about the privacy or the civil liberties or whatever the decisions you are making before you can make them, even though it might make it better when I go to my friend's house to ring the doorbell, that might be awesome, but maybe not when I'm walking by my boss's house and you just got confused and now just told my boss I'm goofing off from work because I happen to be next door to her house. So, just from a show of hands, how many of you have had privacy as a number one priority in your initial UI design of the last product that you guys were on?
Number one?
As a top priority?
Right. And then how many of you have changed your UI based off of privacy or decisions made off of that? So that's interesting, right? Well, I don't buy the Google argument, but I'm biased. So could somebody talk about one place where they did do that and how in the future we're going to be better able to, or how you think we'll be better able to visually depict those kind of choices before you actually make them?
I did a project last year at Flickr, a photo sharing site, where we love to add to the story that you're telling with your photo by telling us where you took it, basically. And a lot of, you know, camera phones do this now, and more point-and-shoot cameras are starting to do it. So you'll see the photo, and next to it, you'll see a little slice of a map that says, you know, I was in Brazil or whatever, and you can get more info about that. We shipped something last year with a kind of nerdy-sounding name called GeoFences, which is to say, okay, so I want to have this location data on all of my photos, but there's certain places that are private for me, and I only want friends and family who I've identified to be aware of where the certain photos were taken. So you can basically draw a circle around your house on a map or your kid's school or wherever you take a lot of photos. And we change the privacy level for locations on all those photos and hide all that from people out there. That was, you know, a primary We did that because we want more location data, actually. But the goal of the project was to help people feel more comfortable sharing it with us by giving, you know, easy to use, obvious tools for making things more private, actually. If you give people that opportunity and they know that they can always do it, they're then more willing to share with you the stuff that they don't need to manage the privacy with as much.
I think one of the things that I've seen is that at some point it gets hard to balance out privacy versus delight in a user experience. So if you're setting up all these roadblocks where a user has to constantly say, like, no, I don't want to share, or yes, I want to share, all of a sudden whatever they were trying to do has become incredibly cumbersome and they don't want to do it anymore. So for me personally, I was working on a project last year where you could touch your two devices together and share information from one to two. So you touch your phone to your tablet, maybe the article you're reading on your phone is now moved over your tablet, you can keep reading it. And there were a lot of questions about, like, how do we design this in a way that you're not going to accidentally share a website that you're not supposed to be looking at with, like, your mom or something when she accidentally touches her phone to yours. And it was a great question, right? Because how do you solve that problem? Whereas at the same time, when you do want to share something with your mom and you tap it, you have to say, yes, I want to share. Are you sure? Yes, I'm sure I want to share. Like, that's ridiculous also. So, you know, it's something that I think is incredibly hard to balance, but very important to be thinking about.
Yeah, the other thing I'd add is I think there's been an interesting trend of people starting to show a little bit more of why things are happening in the user experience. Yeah. So you'll see recommendations come up with a link that says, this is being recommended to you because of this. And it helps to raise the customer's awareness of the information that you're using to make those recommendations. And to some extent, gives them some control at that point to say, I don't want to do that. And so
that's a great idea. That sort of transparency always is a great idea.
Okay, next question, last question.
Last question.
Almost not last question. I'm getting the hook. We're going to go with one last question, though. Okay.
Hi, I have the mic. Yeah. Sorry, all you guys.
You win.
I preempted.
You win.
I'm working on some fairly complex B2B software, and it requires a demo, usually. And so I wanted to get your perspective on, I'm actually trying to build a how this works video right now, and I've seen some really good ones out there and I've seen some really horrible ones out there. So in terms of training the user to use your product right the first time or at least the second time, because getting on and giving each and every user a demo gets harder and harder and harder as you get bigger and huger, like I hope to get. So I was curious your perspective on this sort of pre-user training to make sure that they're successful in their very first time using.
I guess I'll throw in an answer and then everyone can jump in. The first thing I'd say is, you know, try really, really, really hard to make that first time user experience not require the training. And I know that's not necessarily the answer you're looking for, but in to some extent I'd say spend as much time as you are thinking about that next thing in that experience. Second, I'd say is, I've seen pretty good stuff happen when you help make that first-time user experience great within the product. So less of getting out of the product and having to go watch a video and more of how does the product itself give you clues of how to use it and how to get started, and so that first-time customer experience is helpful and that there are clues along the way that lead you down the path to get that first-time experience going.
Yeah, if I could just give an example, think of the very first time you used Salesforce, and was it that easy to use? Was it that easy to, interface with and get all that intuitive stuff right at the first time? So it's complex for certain types of software.
Yeah, I think I totally get that. I think that in many cases, I've seen some folks do first time user layers almost, where it says, you know, like taking Salesforce, just say, add a customer, and that's the only button you can press when you open it the first time, or something like that, where you're really steering the customer down that first time experience so that they're up and running and that they uncover the sophistication of your software as they step through those steps.
I think it's better to solve this problem in the design up front, in the simplicity, and then try to solve it with training materials later.
The trick with videos is that they're very expensive to produce and highly disposable. So the next time you change your interface, you have the exact same cost to create a new training video and a new training video. So if you feel like you have to go down that route, cut it up into a lot of small pieces so that you can replace bits of it. And don't ever fire the person who does the voice.
And on that note, I think we're done.
Awesome.
Let's thank our panelists.